I'm Jim O'Grady. Today we have a story from 1979. It's about how a photo and a fishing trip changed the American presidency. And it's about how a president's sense of moral purpose, the thing that carried him into office, fueled his downfall. Producer Julia Wetherell is here.
Hey, Jim.
We've been talking to people in Plains, Georgia. That's the birthplace of Jimmy Carter.
That's right.
And I guess the first thing to say about Plains is it's a very small town.
It is. Only about 770 people live there.
Jimmy Carter grew up there, and he lives there now.
Yeah, and Plains also has the historic site that includes Carter's small wooden boyhood home, which had a water pump and an outhouse.
And we talked by phone to Millard English.
I'm from Plains, Georgia.
Who works as a tour guide at the Jimmy Carter National Historic Site in Plains.
I was born and raised here.
He told us a story about how during Carter's presidency, while Carter is vacationing home back in Plains, a pack of reporters show up. And one day the president goes out to work on a swampy part of his land, and he's wearing hip waders. But the reporters are in leather shoes, and they're trying to keep up.
They were in the coat and ties and about 95 degrees that day, so they got tired down in the woods, so they sat down on the dam, and they found out about red bugs.
They found out about red bugs. The city slickers came down south, and got bitten alive by red bugs. And this is really a big story in American politics, going back to, like, Abraham Lincoln and Andrew Jackson growing up in log cabins. And this story is this. City folk are corrupt, or at least they lack common sense. And if you want a leader with strong values, someone who can split a rail and knows about red bugs, elect someone from a small town.
Carter plays up that small town mythology in all of his campaigns.
Jimmy Carter knows what it's like to work for a living. He still puts in 12 hours a day in his shirt sleeves on the farm at Plains during peanut harvest.
Yeah, and once Jimmy Carter jumps into politics in 1961, he moves up really steadily. First, he becomes a Georgia state senator, and then in 1971, he runs for governor.
And he wins. But before his term as governor is even done, Jimmy Carter steps up to a microphone.
My name is Jimmy Carter, and I'm running for president.
He's a long shot in a crowded field of contenders for the Democratic nomination. But listen to how Walter Cronkite describes Carter on the CBS Evening News.
He's a peanut farmer, a Baptist deacon, an 11-year Navy veteran, and a nuclear engineer.
So Carter's got a few things going for him. It's the height of the Cold War, and he's a military man. He's also a folksy Southerner. And from the beginning, Carter has another asset, according to Millard English.
He's unbelievably honest. That's one thing they all say. They talk about his honesty.
That's the image he offers to voters disillusioned by the previous decade of what Carter calls the slick and cynical politics of Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon.
I see an America that is turned away from scandals and corruption.
Jimmy Carter ran as an outsider. He was one of those people who said, I'm not inside the Beltway. I'm not part of the Washington, D.C. establishment.
That's Kevin Madsen. He's a professor of contemporary history at Ohio University.
I'm running against Watergate. I'm running against Vietnam and the legacy of Vietnam. I'm running against all these problems.
This is my vision of America. I hope you share it.
Carter wins the Democratic primary. And then he goes on to beat Gerald Ford in the 1976 election.
I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Jimmy Carter gets off to a strong start as president, especially in foreign policy.
On the White House lawn, in the windy sun, President Carter, President Sadat, and Prime Minister Begin sat together to sign an historic peace treaty.
Egypt and Israel have been at war, on and off, since 1948. But in early 1979, Carter brings the countries together to hammer out a peace agreement, an agreement that holds to this day.
Tonight is entitled, A Framework for Peace in the Middle East.
It's a huge achievement, and it helps win Carter the Nobel Peace Prize.
Political observers say it's Carter's reputation as an honest broker that gets the deal done, and polls at the time put Carter's approval rating at a solid 51%. But then comes the summer of 1979.
The first stages of the Iranian Revolution.
A monarch fell in Iran, ultimately to be replaced by a religious leader with visions of a 7th century Islamic Republic and a burning hatred for the United States.
And this creates an enormous gas crisis.
That's Kevin Madsen again.
There are huge gas lines, and on the gas lines there's reports of Americans murdering other Americans. There's a report of a pregnant woman watching her husband get killed in front of her on a gas line.
Mattson wrote a book in 2009 about how, in 1979, voters began to have serious doubts about Jimmy Carter.
He's faced with inflation. He's faced with numerous foreign policy issues that he's finding difficult to handle. And I think the biggest problem that he has is that he's being told by many people in his administration that he has a real problem of credibility and his ability to govern and to be taken seriously.
Carter needs to show not only that he's honest, but that he's not losing his grip on the job. So the White House announces that on July 5th, the president will give a major speech.
At the very last moment, he decides he doesn't want to just give this speech about the gas crisis. He wants to give this bigger speech about the civic crisis that he thinks the gas crisis represents. So he cancels the speech at the last moment.
And he writes a new one.
Good evening.
10 days later, on July 15th, 1979.
This is a special night for me.
Carter appears on TV and tells the nation that the problem is not just the energy crisis. It goes far beyond that. The problem is apathy and the spiritual bankruptcy of the disco decade and its culture of consumption.
The erosion of our confidence in the future is threatening to destroy the social and the political fabric of America.
Carter's rivals, Ronald Reagan and Senator Ted Kennedy, used the speech to paint Carter as a pessimist and a wimp.
It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will.
But here's a fact that's almost totally lost to history. The speech is a success.
Yeah, and that's surprising because that speech, it's called the Malay speech, has gone down in history as a bomb.
Yeah, but right afterward, Carter's poll numbers jumped by 11%. A lot of Americans who watch the speech say that they like it for its idealism.
Whenever you have a chance, say something good about our country. With God's help and for the sake of our nation, it is time for us to join hands in America.
So now Carter's rebounding.
Yeah, but then he ignores his own advice. Instead of joining hands with the people around him, he fires five of his cabinet members.
Ugh. Panic move.
That's right. Carter is starting to seem unstable. He's calling for calm and confidence, and at the same time, he's making his advisors walk the plank.
There are rumors that he might have actually become certifiably insane.
Okay, so to recap, we have a historic peace treaty, and that's immediately followed by foreign unrest, soaring gas prices, and a terrible economy. Oh, and maybe the president is insane. Then Carter gives a speech that's a success for a moment. But a week later, people are seeing it as the president taking 30 minutes on national television to scold them for their problems. All these things hurt the Carter presidency, but not as badly as what comes next, the attack that will change the way every president since Carter manages his image.
My name is Brooks Jackson. I'm a journalist. And at the time this all happened, I was working for the Associated Press.
In late August 1979, a highly placed member of the Carter administration reveals to Brooks Jackson that, a few months before, the president had survived a sneak attack. Jackson, Mattson, Millard English, and another Plains resident, Steve Theus, tell us the story.
The president was sitting around with some of his senior staff and told him the most amazing thing had happened.
The incident occurs in April of 1979. He's kind of vacationing, taking a break from the presidency, and he is out fishing close by to his home in Plains, Georgia.
And he went out on a fishing trip in a little John boat, a little small boat, and was just kind of relaxing, I guess, getting back to nature in the spring of 1979.
Carter's sitting in a boat when he hears a noise from behind. Something is swimming towards him. It's an animal.
It was hissing, tried to get in the boat, and he had to fend it off with an oar.
They had to chase him away with the paddles, but he went on over to the shore and took off into the woods.
So the leader of the free world is attacked by some kind of animal.
He had been approached by a swimming rabbit.
A rabbit.
A big one, he said. A killer rabbit.
The swamp rabbit, the one that supposedly swam out to President Carter's boat. It is probably about twice as large as a cottontail rabbit, the smaller rabbits that we have around here.
A swamp rabbit.
Well, the important thing isn't so much the rabbit as what the rabbit comes to represent.
So this rabbit story sounds like the kind of thing you tell over a beer to get a laugh, and, you know, then that's it. You drop it. You move on.
It's destined to be a forgotten anecdote in Jimmy Carter's life. That is, until Brooks Jackson, the AP reporter, hears about it during a particularly slow news week.
One of the early things I learned as a young reporter at the AP, people love animal stories a lot more than they want to know about current events or what their taxes are going to be or what's going to happen to the Social Security system.
If you've got your hands on a killer rabbit story, you run with it.
Jackson calls the rabbit a bonsai bunny, after the battle cry of Japanese fighter pilots during World War II. His AP story appears in papers across the country. Soon, the major TV networks are airing stories on the bonsai bunny. Jackson's story explodes into commentaries, cartoons, and goofy novelty songs.
President Carter got into his boat. Wasn't in a hurry, wanted to float. Think about the country, think about sin. Along swam a rabbit and he tried to climb in. And what did Jimmy say? I don't want a bunny, bunny in my widow old boat. In my widow old boat in the pond.
The rabbit story makes Carter look small, and then it takes on another meaning.
I thought the significance of it was that this is the president who got elected saying, I will never lie to you, but nobody believed it.
For the bunny might be crazy and it bite me in the foot, in my widow boat in the pond.
They didn't believe Carter's explanation of what happened, or even that rabbits could swim. And this is where Jimmy Carter's devotion to honesty starts to tip into moral vanity. Instead of just letting the story blow over, he makes it worse. Here's Mattson and Jackson.
He actually wanted to see if there was a White House photographer who happened to be there taking photographs of his vacation.
There had been a photograph taken, and even then they didn't believe it. He had to have him go back and make a blow-up of it so that they could make out that there really were long ears on that creature swimming out to approach his boat.
Here's what we know from a memoir by Carter's press secretary, Jody Powell. Powell says Carter tells some White House staffers one day that not only is the story true, but the rabbit was enraged or berserk. It was gnashing its teeth, and it looked like it wanted to climb into the boat with him. Carter then asks the staffers whether they believe him, and the staffers, like a lot of Americans, say, "Not really, Mr. President." Carter can't stand not being believed, so he orders up the photo that will go on to become as famous as the story itself, a photo that will haunt him for the rest of his life.
And the timing is terrible for Carter. Here's Kevin Mattson.
I think in many ways, the story of the killer rabbit incident only makes sense when you understand what else was going on during the summer of 1979.
Carter seems like he's lost control of events. Right when there's a presidential election coming up.
It really helped solidify the image that Ronald Reagan wanted to project for himself. He wanted to be the strong, effective, tough sort of guy. He wanted to stand up to the Russians, to renew the Cold War. He had a really kind of bold persona.
The kind of tough guy who wouldn't be intimidated by, say, a rabbit.
Strength, restraint, inspired leadership. Reagan for president.
And besides Reagan, Carter's facing another political threat.
Teddy Kennedy was thinking of running against him, almost unprecedented for a president to be challenged from within his own party for re-election. When it made the front page of the Washington Post with a huge editorial cartoon, the movie Jaws was out then, and if you've seen the poster for that old classic, it's a giant shark coming up vertically from the bottom of a clueless swimmer about to swallow her up. The cartoon was a giant rabbit coming up under the hapless president's boat.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
And the rabbit looked a lot like Teddy Kennedy. So.
By the fall of 1979, the story of the killer rabbit finally fades from the news cycle. But the damage is already done. A Washington Post poll gives Carter the lowest approval rating of any president in three decades. Then another attack occurs. A serious one.
Some 60 Americans, including our fellow citizen whom you just saw bound and blindfolded, are now beginning their sixth day of captivity inside the U.S. Embassy in Tehran.
The Iranian hostage crisis.
It was the premier political event that dominated the last years of the Carter presidency.
Carter never recovered.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear.
And this is really the start of a new era in American politics.
That's true. You know, Reagan's man, Michael Deaver, he was a deputy chief of staff. He was the first guy to figure out that the president's image, you know, the visual he projects in public, is as important as the words he says. And sometimes it's more important because Deaver learned the lesson of the bonsai bunny. If you don't control the narrative, someone else will. If you don't ride the rabbit, the rabbit rides you.
What did Jimmy say? I don't want a bunny wunny in my widow old boat. In my widow old boat.
And that's the story of how a bunny wunny changed American history. Thanks, Julia.
No problem.
That's producer Julia Weatherill. I'm Jim O'Grady. Thanks to Dean Capello and Chris Bannon and WNYC's large-hearted archivist, Andy Lancet, and to Ace Engineer, John Delore. And thanks to you for listening. By the way, Julia tried to reach Carter to ask him about the killer rabbit, but his press secretary turned her down. CNN got Carter to talk about it in 2010. The president began by debunking the idea that rabbits can't swim.
Wild animals, you know, wild rabbits, wild squirrels, raccoons, foxes, and so forth, all of them know how to swim. Otherwise, they couldn't go from one place to another and cross a creek.
And again, at the end of the interview, Carter wants everyone to know it's true, damn it, rabbits do swim.
By the way, after that, a lot of people that had tame bunny rabbits threw them into swimming pools and so forth around the nation and wrote me and said that rabbit could swim too.
I did not know.
Think about how those letters from ordinary Americans must have comforted Jimmy Carter. Because what they were saying was, we believe you, Mr. President. We believe you. Because our rabbit didn't sink.
For death awaits you all with nasty big pointy teeth.
What an eccentric performance.